feminism and teaching courses about women, such as the psychology of women. That's our topic this evening. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm your host, John Pierce. Good to have you along with us this evening. My guest is, got a real live one for you. Her name is Dr. Kate Richmond, and she is Associate Professor of Psychology and Director of Women and Gender Studies at Muhlenberg College. She's published in the areas of multicultural psychology, gender ideology, masculinity, transgender resiliency, feminist therapy, and trauma. Wow, what a list. Kate, that's a very long list, I think.
Thank you.
and I'm surprised to see in there masculinity, because you're heavy on women's rights and women's progress and the psychology of women and so forth. So how does masculinity come into this?
Well, first, let me thank you, John, for inviting me to this conversation, because I have found that discussions around feminism isn't something that often many men want to engage in. So thank you. I think it is interesting that people do not put masculinity or understand masculinity connected to women's lives. And yet any woman you probably talk to will say that having men around and experiencing masculinity is very much part of their life. Masculinity is something that defines almost everything in our society. The people who are in positions of power, the people who make major policy decisions, tend to be men. But not only that, they tend to be socialized in a particular way. And that way is to value things like dominance, aggression. You think about early on when little boys cry, the first thing we say to them is, boys don't cry. The message is very clear that to be a boy, to be a man, means to be tough, to be self-reliant. And I think that is deeply connected to women's experiences, because oftentimes that aggression gets directed at women. It also gets directed at other men and boys. And so everyone lives in this perpetual fear of what's going to happen if we break a male code.
So what do we say to a little girl who starts to cry?
I think we expect little girls to cry. We comfort them. We give them hugs.
We might pick them up in our arms.
Absolutely. And I think that sends a very clear message that girls can show emotion and boys not. I'll show you another example of how this plays out. So a while ago, I was working with a client whose little girl, she was six, came home and said that the teacher told her that a boy in the class who was hitting her actually liked her. And the reason he was hitting her and pulling her hair was because he liked her.
Of course.
Right. And that is a message that we've heard. Except what does that send? It sends the message that romance, attraction, is connected to violence. Right. And of course, the little boy hears the same message. Okay, if I want to show that I like a girl, I snap their bra. I pull their hair. And that is the culture of men and masculinity. Now, how does that look when we become adults? Well, we reward men who show those characteristics. I think our current president embodies a lot of the masculine ideals that we hold up. I think the very fact that he is our president shows that we reward men who show a certain level of dominance, a certain level of political and economic capital. And of course, only certain men can achieve those things. Men who have access to power, to wealth, to education, to health and health care. And so some men will benefit from a system of masculinity where other men will not. I think of the many men of color right now in our country who are being disproportionately incarcerated, or the men who are being literally shot by police officers. Those men do not have the same kind of access to showing aggression, showing leadership, showing violence in the same way, because they are punished for it. Where other men, particularly white men, white able-bodied, heterosexual men with financial wealth and privilege, will be rewarded for those same kind of shows of dominance and aggression. So the system is a little complicated. When we talk about masculinity, we can't talk about it separate from other things like race, class, socioeconomic status, excuse me, I said that already, disability, because these things are all interconnected. And right. I think one of the things that feminism is giving right now is the belief that we cannot no longer just look at gender in isolation.
Now, you are associate professor of psychology and director of women and gender studies at Muhlenberg College. You also just mentioned that something about a client mm-hmm. who came to you. So you also have a private practice.
Yes, I do.
And how does that work? Tell us a little bit about that.
So I am a licensed clinical psychologist, and I've always felt that the balance of being a college professor while also being a practicing therapist has been an asset. When you're studying to be a psychologist, we're trained to know that a lot of what we offer is the science of psychology, that we're not just there to make people quote-unquote feel better, but we are there to offer insights into how people can have better mental health. And so staying connected to the academy has always been a priority for me because it keeps me sharp on the research. But then staying connected with clients keeps me focused on people's real lives. It is very easy when you are in an academic setting to forget that when we talk about racism, when we talk about masculinity, when we talk about trauma, that this is not an intellectual exercise. These are people's lives. This is the difference between being able to get up and feel like you can have a nice quality of life or a good day versus literally not getting out of bed. And so it is humbling to be a therapist because there's so many ways that in the academy you can be rewarded for publishing a great paper or giving a great lecture. But then you get back into the trenches and you realize that the whole point of that is to give psychology back, to give our knowledge that we create in the field to the people who need it the most.
And your publics there, the people with whom you're working, on the one hand, are students, basically 18 to 22 years old, so not that much experience in life yet. Mm-hmm. And they're studying it from an intellectual standpoint. And then you have your clients who are going through some really rough times. Mm-hmm. So two very different publics.
Yeah, I think that the divide between them might not actually be as wide as you think. I think that there are some 18 to 21 year olds who've lived a very fulfilled life. And so, for example, I currently am thinking about the children who are dealing with getting caught in this immigration issue and the trauma they're sustaining. One could argue that they have some insights that my many years of studying trauma will never give me. And so I think that is what being a practicing clinician gives you is the humility to recognize that what you think life looks like or how it's supposed to play out developmentally gets complicated often.
Mm-hmm. My guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse is Dr. Kate Richmond. She is a clinical psychologist and also an associate professor at Muhlenberg College. Kate, let's go back into your background a little bit. Originally coming from where?
So I was born and raised in Philadelphia. I am the oldest of four girls. My father was a Philadelphia police officer. My mother was still is involved in the education system, started off teaching preschool and finished in an administrative position. I really attribute much of my scholarship and professional life to growing up in Philadelphia. I lived in and was in West Philly during the move, which was pretty influential to my childhood. I think recognizing that violence can happen to people in all sorts of ways at a young age, seeing that really transformed how I thought about the world.
So you lived not too far from the campus of Penn.
That's correct. That's correct.
You wound up at Penn also afterwards. Where did you do your undergraduate work for psychology?
So I am an alum of Muhlenberg College. I went to Muhlenberg and fully embraced the liberal arts. I think that the value of liberal arts is so clearly a part of everything I do. I think through the lens of multiple disciplines, and have always valued the ability to do that.
And then after Muhlenberg, master's degree?
I went straight to my PhD program. So when I was applying for grad school, the O.J. Simpson case was happening. Might remember that case.
Oh, yeah.
And I, at the time, was interning at Turning Point, which is the domestic violence shelter and domestic violence program here in the Lehigh Valley, and was very interested in pursuing training in interpersonal violence in particular. So I was watching that OJ case, and I noticed Lenore Walker, who was the expert witness in that case. She had written a book called The Battered Woman Syndrome. The battered woman syndrome is has been used as a defense legally for women who have assaulted or killed their partners as a result or in defense of dealing with abuse. And so when I reached out to her, I said, I'm very interested in pursuing this. Are you taking grad students? She said, yes. I was so excited. I wrote to her, I'm going to apply. I got in and spent 7 years studying under her.
And where was that?
That was at Nova Southeastern University in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. We spent probably the last 3 years of my grad training traveling abroad, interviewing women in different interpersonal violence situations. We interviewed women in shelters, in prisons, in hospitals, trying to really understand the psychological consequences of domestic violence, both personally, but also at a political and cross-cultural level.
Did you do that as your PhD project for your dissertation?
Interesting you should ask. I actually did my dissertation on masculinity, because one of the things I gained from that was that the key of addressing violence, particularly domestic violence or interpersonal violence, was to understand men and why is it they were aggressing so intensely against their partners. And so I spent a lot of time looking at how the pressures on men and the pressures of masculinity create a situation where men are lashing out. I actually had a tremendous amount of empathy and compassion for male perpetrators because so many of them themselves were survivors of violence. And I think there is something about the socialization of masculinity that is itself somewhat traumatic. And I think if we ignore that, we're missing a big piece of the puzzle in trying to create more safe, sustainable, healthy relationships.
And so after you obtained your PhD, you started off teaching, but not at Muhlenberg, correct?
That's correct. I started at the University of Pennsylvania, worked in their counseling program, and simultaneously started my private practice at that time. And initially, I intended to work with people and train people who were planning to become clinicians. And then the allure of the liberal arts brought me back to Muhlenberg.
Uh-huh. And so you started looking for a position where you could teach in a liberal arts college.
That's correct.
And Muhlenberg was the one that came forth and said, we want you to come.
I was so lucky.
How long have you been there now?
I've been at Muhlenberg. This will be my 14th year.
All right. So tenured professor, congratulations.
Thank you.
Yes, and I might add also a popular professor because, and I have a statistic, I have personal data from that. Let me just tell our listeners that I met you because you permitted me to sit in on a course that you taught recently called The Psychology of Women. And when it came around, you went around the room, about 20 students, and asked each one, why are you taking this course? And when it came to me, I said, well, I've been trying to figure out women ever since I was a teenager. This might be my last shot. And so that was what brought me into the course. And so I know your passion for the subject. One of the big topics of the course is feminism. Mm-hmm. And you went through about 7 different types of feminism, which I had no clue about. I just thought it was one big block, feminism. You know, somewhat the way we look at big blocks of things like communism. We'll say, okay, forget about the individual countries. That's what it is, the big C. Mm-hmm. Whereas, and feminism, maybe our listeners are in that same position. But there are different kinds of feminism. Mm-hmm. And what does that amount to?
I'm glad you brought that up, because I actually think it's intentional that feminism gets clumped into one ideological understanding. I think that is part of the way in which politics allows for feminists to be, or people who identify with feminism, to be shamed and to be stigmatized and to sort of create a stereotypical image of what feminism is. And you see this with other, for example, racial and ethnic minorities, that everyone who is Black is seen to be the same.
Correct.
It is based on a stereotype. And of course, that is politically useful, because then you can shame or clump people to be all the same. Why I think it's so important that students understand the diversity within feminism is because it is really a school of thought. It is a way to approach both political problems, but also personal ones that don't have easy answers. And so, yes, you can follow the waves. And I know some folks in the field don't like the metaphor of waves. You know, we have a first wave in this country of women's rights. We have a second wave, and then a third. Those waves are come about during particular historical moments. So the issues that were faced at that time reflect the theories that are coming out during that time. And so they're often in conflict with one another. And so why is it so hard to get a political movement together with women? It's because the interests vary tremendously. And that conflict in the end is something that helps us if we can identify it and work through it, versus ignore that it's there in the first place.
You talk about different waves of feminism. When approximately did the first wave begin?
So I think most people put the first wave as during the suffrage movement. And different historians have various ideas about that, but I think that's the first wave. The second wave comes during the 1950s, 1960s movements, kind of coexisting with the civil rights, rise in the civil rights movements. Betty Friedan's very famous book, The Feminine Mystique. I think the third wave, some argue we're still in the third wave, really gets kicked off with the advent of technology and the advancement of things like Facebook and Twitter and the ability to communicate a particular movement across many different people in a way that you couldn't before. And the third wave also ushers in a focus on the way in which the first and second wave was primarily about white women, white, wealthy, straight women. And so we really owe a lot of gratitude towards women of color who continually tried to bring this to the attention of the women's movement. But women of color really have given us the lens that if we only talk about a general woman, the tendency is to believe that those women are white, able-bodied, wealthy. And then we create movements that showcase and highlight the needs of those women. And the third waivers are making us step back and say, wait a minute, this movement has to be about everyone. And if it's not, then it's not going to do what we need it to do.
It's time for us to take a break here on Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm John Pierce, your host. Good to have you along with me this evening. Doing our engineering is Neil Heaver, our director of operations, and my guest, Dr. Kate Richmond. And stay with us now. We'll be back in just a moment.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
Dr. Kate Richmond, my guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY, has a forthcoming book, an undergraduate textbook, called Psychology of Women. Is that the working title? So
it is officially the title.
It is officially. All right. And it will be published by W.W. Norton. Congratulations.
Thank you. We're really excited about it.
Publisher, indeed. And that is supposed to be in January 2019. So let's keep our fingers crossed that that'll hold steadily. In addition to teaching, and she has a private practice, we've talked about that, and she specializes in the treatment of trauma and issues related to gender. Well, let's talk about another project that you have going, Kate, and that is, it's a course called Inside Out. What's that one?
So the Inside Out class is... stems from a program that started at Temple University called the Inside Out Prison Exchange. And the concept is to take undergraduate students into a jail or prison and also take a group of folks who are incarcerated, about 15 students at the undergrad level and then 15 students who are incarcerated, and put them in a class together for an entire semester.
Wow.
To... talk about issues related to prison and mass incarceration.
Where do you hold these classes?
So this semester I was at the LTRIC, which is the Lehigh County Corrections Center. It's in Bethlehem. And so we had 15 Muhlenberg students join, 15 of students who are incarcerated. And we spent 14 weeks together talking about different issues specific to Lehigh County, actually. And the students did readings, wrote papers. Everyone did the same readings, wrote the same papers. And then the class culminated with a closing ceremony that happened at Muhlenberg College. We were fortunate enough to have the Lehigh County facilities agree to bus our students who were incarcerated to Muhlenberg. And during that closing ceremony, the students presented projects that they had worked on in groups to create an intervention specific to Lehigh County that would address the issue of mass incarceration.
Now, how were the groups formed? Was it a couple from the jail and a couple from the campus?
That's correct. And but most of the students picked the topic that they were most interested in. So the five topics that they could choose from were dealing with the school-to-prison pipeline, dealing with mental health crisis in the prisons, dealing with work and how to find work once you are released or leave prison, media and how media, particularly how media in the Lehigh County address prison, justice, and mass incarceration. And then the last was racism and how do we address the systemic racism that exists in our prison systems.
You mentioned one of those, campus to prison pipeline. What does that mean?
So the school-to-prison pipeline is the phenomenon that many kids, particularly kids of color, particularly boys of color, are identified in early in their education as potential. So let me take a step back. Boys of color are far more likely to be sent to the principal than white boys. Girls of color are more likely to be disciplined for behaviors that white girls do but won't receive the same disciplinary action. What happens when you get kids who are consistently sent to the principal, consistently sent to disciplinary action, is it sets up a pattern where they perceive themselves to be bad kids. Schools perceive themselves to be bad kids. Those kids then get caught often in a system. And once you are caught in a system of any kind of juvenile delinquency situation, your chances of being able to get out of that are very low. And so a lot of the delinquency stuff happens so much earlier than people realize. And there are inequities in it. And so when we say school to prison pipeline, we're really talking about what happens to kids of color in schools that then sets them up to potentially move to a route of prison versus something like higher education. And my fantasy, of course, and it is a fantasy because it's a drop in the bucket to what needs to happen, was to allow higher ed to go into the prisons, allow access to education for people who don't have it, and also to bring people who are in higher education into situations so that they can see what is happening. It is one thing to sit in a college class and debate the death penalty as an intellectual exercise. It is a total another thing to sit with someone who might face that and have a conversation about it and to really talk through what it literally means to put someone to death.
Yes, indeed.
It's a different conversation. There's empathy. There is hopefully some recognition of the humanity in those kind of conversations. And the one thing that has always made me dislike the college classroom is the fact that it becomes an intellectual game. It becomes it's just too easy to fall into it as a cognitive task, rather one where these are people's lives.
Exactly. And with this Inside Out Prison Exchange course that you teach, what's the breakdown of men and women in this from the campus and from the jail?
That's a great question. In general, we tend to have many more female students from Muhlenberg enroll in that class. Some of that has to do with the fact that because I teach women's studies, because I teach psychology, I tend to draw more women. I would love to see more men take those kind of classes, but many, many of the students who are from Muhlenberg are women. They tend to be white women. Of the two men who took the class from Muhlenberg, they were both of color. So I think that kind of is an interesting commentary on how students pick the type of classes they're going to take. In the LTRIC side, we had LTRIC was somewhat unique insofar as they let the male students and the female students come to the class together. So of all of those students, let's see, the breakdown, I think it was pretty even between male and female students and higher number of students of color than white students incarcerated.
And the ones who were incarcerated, what were their ages?
At the LTRIC, they tend to be on the younger side. So I think they were in their 20s, most of them. However, I do some work at Greaterford, which is a maximum security prison closer to College, Collegeville in Schwanksville, in Collegeville. And those folks are serving life sentences. And those people, because it's a male-only prison at this time, they tend to be primarily men of color, and a lot of them have spent most, if not all, of their life in that building.
Have you done this kind of course, the Inside Out, at Greaterford as well?
So I was trained by Temple, and the training happens in collaboration with Greaterford. So there are a group of us that meet every Wednesday. I've been going there every Wednesday for the last 4 years.
Going there, where's there?
To Greaterford on Wednesday evenings. And so it consists of 7 faculty members and community organizers and activists, and about 9 men who have received either their master's or PhDs through correspondence courses. Many of them are serving life sentences, and we get together every Wednesday to discuss the program and to talk about how to do best practices around education, both within the prison and outside of the prison. Because I think one of the things that is the most damaging part about the public's perception of people who are in prison is that that they shouldn't have access to education, that if you're serving a life sentence, somehow you should never get the capacity or the ability to have access to knowledge, have access to conversation.
That's pretty sad, because that's at the very basic level, it's a way to pass time, is to learn.
I agree. Yeah. And because I value education so much, I also think there is something very much about being human and education that are deeply connected and having dignity. I think often of Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning, and he wrote that when he was in a concentration camp. And he kept saying that the ability to create meaning in your life is what helps you overcome very difficult situations. And I think if anyone has been in a prison, you can see that our country does not have prisons that are very humane. And I think we all have to take a look at ourselves and think through why that is, and why we are so willing to treat people, even people who have done horrendous things in their lives, so poorly, and not have a certain degree of mercy.
When you deal with the students in Inside Out Prison Exchange, does the topic of religious faith come up? Is it fairly frequent?
I think it comes up. I don't think it is as frequent as you might expect, but it does come up. I think when I go to Greaterford, there is a fair number of religious figures who are there, and I do think one of the things about the class is, because of the intensity of a class, there is a sense of spirituality, a sense of deep connection with one another that I think gives rise to that feeling of trying to make meaning and having a sense of spirituality, and for some folks, religious understanding of that. So yes, I think on some level it comes up, but I don't think in terms of religious traditions or religiosity, I don't think that is as much focus of the class.
Let's go back to something that you said a couple of minutes ago about having more female students at Muhlenberg College than you do male students because of your discipline, psychology. Mm-hmm. Forget about feminism or women's studies, just in general. Do you know any percentage of women versus men who are taking psychology these days?
It's a great question. I can't off the top of my head, but I can tell you that the field is much more female dominated. Although it is interesting, at the collegiate level, there are many men who are in faculty positions. I don't know the numbers men to women, but I can tell you that if you look at our journals in psychology, which arguably are a marker of who gets to create the field because the journals are what creates the knowledge, there are many, many more men who are editors than there are women, with the exception of the Child Development Journal and the Family Journals, which of course makes sense because women are socialized and are seen as experts on the family and experts on child development. But in any other indices in psychology, men are still the ones who are driving the knowledge. Women are the ones who are practicing. Women are the ones who are out there doing therapy, doing program assessment, that kind of stuff. So you do see the disparities in who has the power in the field.
Right. That's a little bit like cooks and chefs. The really, really famous chefs tend to be men, mm-hmm. whereas across the globe, women are the ones who are usually doing the cooking.
Another great example is education. Men tend to be the principals and superintendents. The women are the teachers. And even more so, the women are the ones who teach elementary school. You get to high school, you might have some more male teachers. And you get to college, you even get more. So you can see how the power and the pay difference plays a role in who's showing up.
I was just going to mention the pay as partly a reason that that psychology would attract women more than men. It's not a profession known for high pay.
It used to be, ironically. It used to be, but because of feminization, that's the term that often gets used when women go into a field, the salaries shifted. And so when women enter any field at higher numbers, the salaries tend to go down. Likewise, when men enter a field that is mostly female-dominated, their pay tends to go up. That's called the glass escalator. It's a phenomenon when a man enters a female-dominated profession, say nursing, teaching, they tend to get promoted faster, they tend to get paid higher. So the opposite effect happens when men go into female-dominated professions. The field itself doesn't go up in pay, but those individual men get rewarded.
Interesting. Dr. Kate Richmond is my guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. And we're talking about feminism, about masculinity, about working with college students and inmates from prison. Kate, you recently attended a conference in Miami, and I'd like you to tell us a little bit about that. Sounds interesting.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, so fantastic opportunity to go to Miami. It was beautiful there. Myself and four other colleagues about 8 years ago started a institute called the Institute for Academic Feminist Psychologists. And the idea was to support faculty, especially junior faculty, faculty who are new, in their pursuit to get tenure. So if you're not familiar with higher education, one of the main things that you work toward when you start a job as a faculty member is tenure. Tenure gives you the capacity to publish and teach in a way where you can stay true to the knowledge without fear of political ramifications, meaning getting fired for saying something that's not popular. And what happens for a lot of women who study feminism is that they are on the defense because it's not always the most popular belief system. And so we created this institute to support faculty so that they could work towards tenure, using the tools of science that we know work in psychology, but also being able to support the personal exhaustion that is associated with teaching some of these more difficult topics. It is not easy to teach about rape. It's not easy to talk about abortion. It's not easy to talk about mass incarceration and the death penalty. But oftentimes what I find so fascinating is people say, well, those topics are too difficult to teach. However, if we don't teach them, if we don't talk to students about how to have conversations about rape, how to have conversations about abortion, violence, mass incarceration, racism, then we will never have that conversation. And this is something that affects all of us. And so it is so critical that we have faculty who are skilled at helping people have these dialogues.
I must say that in the course in which I observed you teaching and observed my fellow students, these topics that are difficult topics came up pretty easily, and because you led the students to feel all right about even pronouncing a word like rape, which I don't even like to pronounce.
Yeah.
And it comes from the teacher, it comes from the mood that you set, and you have done that well with your students. It is a very important point that you make, that if we don't start somewhere, we're never going to have the conversation. If we don't have the conversation, we're really not admitting that there are problems, and then we're stuck, we're sunk.
Yes, I agree.
Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY. We come to you every Thursday, 6 p.m. As I like to say, if it's Thursday and 6 p.m., that means Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org, serving the Lehigh Valley and beyond. We're Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm John Pierce, your host. So glad to have you with me this evening, along with our guest, Dr. Kate Richmond, and also our engineer, Neil Heaver, who's working the board for us. Time to take a break now, and stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and you receive a tax deduction. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love on WDIY. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Dr. Kate Richmond, my guest, has been recognized on several occasions for excellence in teaching. In 2004, she received the Adjunct Faculty of the Year at Nova Southeastern University. In 2008, she was given the Muhlenberg College Students' Choice Award for Faculty of the Year. And in 2013, she received the Paul C. Empey Memorial Award for Excellence in Teaching. Congratulations, Kate, for those accolades. It makes one feel good when accomplishments are recognized, yeah, shall we say. Mm-hmm. And very often in teaching, it's the case that you do not hear from former students very much, "I appreciate so much your course," or "You really led me on a positive path." Mm-hmm. It's all too infrequent. I know that. And so I like to see people rewarded for what they've done. Now, we're talking a lot about feminism in this interview. My question, I have two questions for you. First of all, do I dare go home and announce to my family that I'm a feminist? Here, I'm a man. Please.
So I'm going to start this with a funny story. I was working on my dissertation, which happened to be about masculinity. And we were in, I was sleeping at night, and there was a string of robberies that were happening in my neighborhood. Cars were being broken into. And so I was a little bit on edge about the safety of our house and the safety of my car. And I was laying in bed next to my husband, and we both heard a glass shatter. We both jumped up. And I said, "Steve, go downstairs, check out what that was." And he looked at me straight in the face, and he said, "You're the feminist. You go downstairs and check." And I said, "Touché. You're right. How dare I buy into these gender stereotypes when I am always outwardly trying to fight them?"
Yeah.
To tell you the truth, we both walked down together to check it out. The fact that I would assume that he wasn't afraid of this in the same way I was is a sign that even someone who studies feminism and fights against sexism all the time can fall easily to the stereotypes of gender.
Yeah, so what does that leave for people who don't study these things, don't think about it very much, and they see movies, they see TV, they see the way husbands and wives act and react, and the woman always asks the man for help in these situations?
Yes, I agree. Sure. And I think the other idea that gets embedded in boys and men's heads is that they always have to be the quote-unquote hero. And, you know, I was thinking when the pilot in New York landed the plane in the Hudson, I was listening to some of the folks who said that the first thing they told everyone on the plane was that women and children would leave first. And I remember thinking, I don't think I could leave my husband. Why should I leave him? And that it would be really hard for me to do that. And it was the first time that I realized in that moment that it is very challenging to think about how all of these gender stereotypes create expectations for us to do things that put pressures on our relationships that really make it hard to feel connected to one another.
That's really an interesting point. I would not want to have left my husband just because I'm a woman and we have a daughter, and the two of us should be shepherded to safety first, and maybe he doesn't ever make it.
Right.
So now that you've mentioned...
I bring up that point, sure, too? Because another situation that made me think about that was the shooting in the movie theater in Colorado, or where so many of the men jumped in front of their girlfriends or wives or partners as a way to protect them from these bullets. And I kept thinking again and again, this man died because of this heroic act. And yet the woman has to sit with that for the rest of her life.
Correct.
And so, you know, again, that dynamic of benevolence, that suggestion that men should take more hits, that men should cover women, is itself a form of sexism, of course, because it suggests that women can't do it. But it also ignores the pain that women might have to live with that decision being made for her.
You've mentioned your husband, and we've talked about your daughter. Let's give him a shout out here. So your husband is Steve.
That's correct. My daughter is Jessica.
All right. And she's 3 years old.
She's three.
And is it too strong to say you have a love-hate relationship with your daughter? You can be honest here, just the listeners and me.
To be fair, my daughter is obsessed with princess culture. And you can imagine the stress of a feminist women's studies professor dealing with a daughter who wants to buy and wear every Disney princess dress possible. And so the conflict comes with the parenting decision to want to support her interest and let her follow her love of certain things, combined with the reality of recognizing some of the damaging parts of princess culture, both in terms of its focus on consumption and buying things and putting, you know, things in your hair and having to, you know, do all that, but also in terms of the messages that some of these princesses send about finding a man to make your dreams come true.
Yeah, sure.
And there's also a huge focus on, you know, heterosexism and the idea that most girls will want to be with a man at the end of their journey. And so there are a lot of messages that are hard to counter, with a three-year-old, although I do make my attempts often to do that.
I hope the two of those attempts are no high heel shoes yet at age three.
She does have a pair of high heels. It bothers me, John.
Oh.
I can tell you that, it pains me. I think, you know, you're not going to get away from sexism. She's never going to be in a place where she's not exposed to that. So I think a better approach, or the approach that I've sort of adopted, is to talk to her about it constantly and to ask her, you know, do those shoes hurt? She can barely walk in them.
Wow. And but she wants to try.
Of course.
Even at age three.
Of course.
What about makeup?
She has chapstick. She hasn't gotten that far into makeup, but she does have chapstick.
Okay. No eyeshadow yet.
No, God, I hope not.
But you haven't been home yet tonight.
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, so Dr. Kate Richmond, my guest this evening, and we are talking about topics around feminism and sexism and gender questions. So I have one for you, Kate, and it's about feminism, since we've mentioned that here on the program. My first question was, could I actually proclaim myself to be a feminist? You didn't really answer that.
I was just going to say, I'm sorry I didn't answer your question.
But what you said was more interesting, so fine. So we all know that the answer is, of course I can. Though I think John Q. Public thinks that feminists are women.
Mm-hmm.
And that if I, as a man, am feminist, I'm somehow weak. I'm being a little bit too touchy-feely, mm-hmm. and all those things.
And can I stop you there? Because I think the research shows that. If you look at data points, it'll show that, in general, people perceive men who identify as feminist as more weak, as effeminate. So I do think that reality is there. However, there's other research that shows that men who identify with feminists, particularly when they're heterosexual, end up having reporting better marital satisfaction, better sexual satisfaction. So there is that flip of it too, which is, although you'll be perceived as weak, there are some benefits for men who identify as feminists. And men who call out sexism in workplace settings are often taken more seriously than when women do it. So men have a real role to play in helping address sexism in our society. I think, you know, back to that locker room talk situation that came up during the 2016 election, you know, I'll never be in a locker room with a group of men to be able to stop conversations that are problematic. But many men are, and they often don't, because of the fear of the backlash you talked about. What happens if I go back and tell my family I'm a feminist?
Now, I'm guessing you've been probably in locker rooms with women.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing you don't have those conversations in there. You don't have those problems come up.
No, not in the same way. And I recognize that locker room is a metaphor for other things, because the locker room probably isn't as difficult as, for example, the corporate boardroom or the halls of Congress or the goth outings that men go to with one another. I think these social situations have very big political implications.
All right, so back to feminism. Question is, why do women who are feminists hate men? It just grinds me.
I mean, I think that's a very popular stereotype that's out there, along with, you know, feminists are ugly, or feminists are hairy, or they don't wear bras. I mean, I think that was a very successful campaign in the 80s by our friend Rush Limbaugh, who, you know, compared feminists to feminazis. I've heard all sorts of theories about feminists are responsible for the downfall of society, that if feminists weren't out there, we wouldn't have things like 9/11. I think, you know, there's a lot of scapegoating that happens, and I think that's all intentional because, of course, if you identify as a feminist, it's a stigmatized identity. And so you have to take on that stigma if you want to do it. There is a cost to identify yourself as a feminist. But there is a difference between people who identify as feminists and people who believe in feminist principles. So people who will say, I'm not a feminist, but I believe in gender equality. Those people are people who do believe in gender equality. However, they're less likely to act when they see something happening that is representative of an inequality. So the difference between people who identify as feminists and say I'm a feminist is that they tend to act. They tend to say things. They tend to do things. And to me, that is the definition of feminism. It's not just an intellectual activity. You have to do. You have to say and you have to do.
I would say that most men would go along with most of the principles that I've heard of with feminism. It's simply trying to raise women's status, trying to give women an equal chance and at the workplace and wherever it might be. And so many men would say, well, sure, I'm for that. Are you a feminist? No, that's a little bit tougher of a question. It sounds as if that's your philosophy of life. And maybe that's too strong for most men. But,
and back to the point, though, I think that reinforces the idea that most men do not, and I think the research shows this too, do not intervene when they hear another man saying something sexist. And I think that is exactly what is needed. If men were to identify as feminists, I think they'd be more likely to act. So it's sort of like, yeah, I want these things, but I'm not going to change my life in any way to make sure that they happen. I'm not going to take any risks. And of course, that is, you know, one of the benefits of being a man. You don't have to address sexism if you don't want to. And so I do think men have to take on some of that stigma if they're going to change it. And the question is, what would motivate any man to do that? And my answer to that is, I think men deal with the stresses of masculinity. I mean, that's where we started our conversation. I think men are harmed by it. I've spent hours in therapy talking to men who have been significantly hurt by messages around masculinity, including situations, you know, you can have a man who's in his 60s, 70s who can still remember being a second grader, being shamed for something he said that was perceived to be feminine.
Wow.
And they carry that shame their whole life. I had a situation once where a man had a tumor growing on his back, and he couldn't afford the insurance to get sedation, anesthesia for the surgery. So he went in to have the surgery done without anesthesia.
Oh.
And he subsequently developed PTSD because of it. Tremendously painful situation. And when I asked him why he did that, his answer was, well, I'm a man, I can take the pain.
Oh, wow.
Men are more likely to die earlier than women in this country. When they go to the doctors, they're less likely to ask questions, if they even go to the doctors. This is pretty serious.
Right. It's a sign of weakness to ask others for help. And in my way of thinking, when I think about attendance, for instance, at religious ceremonies, churches, synagogues, and so on, more women than men. And I think the reality is that women are willing to say, I don't have all the answers, much more than men, and I'm not expected to have all the answers. God, help me. Mm-hmm. And men are less likely to do that because it's a sign of so-called weakness.
Yeah, there is a message of self-reliance that men have to absorb and sort of abide by. And I think it's not a personal choice. I think there are real consequences when you don't do those things, whether it's social rejection or more serious violence. You know, the laughing joke is that men never stop for directions, but that it, you know, but men aren't going to doctors, men aren't going to church, men aren't doing those things because the message is crystal clear. You should have the answers, you should do it on your own. And think about what it must feel like day in, day out to believe that you have to do it all yourself. And so why do I think men should be feminists? It's because they benefit men too. It benefits them differently, but I think the quality of men's life would be better if we started to look at masculinity just as much as we looked at women's roles. I think one other point is that the women's movement was very successful at opening up opportunities for women to express different roles and responsibilities in society. I think less so for men. I think men's roles have stayed pretty much the same, and the expectations have stayed the same. And that's the next task for feminism, is to get men to believe that they could stay home with their kids.
Right. And we're starting to hear more about parental leave instead of maternity leave. And that's a good thing. That feminism has brought that about.
I agree. And I think the more and more we can do that, the stronger families become. I often think of the relationships that men had with their fathers in the 1950s. 1960s, particularly in the traditional nuclear white middle-class family, they were very distant. And I think there is something very sad about that for men, that that closeness with their children feels second or secondary.
Would you agree that there is a bond between a mother and a child that cannot be matched between the father and the child?
I don't agree with that. I don't. And I think research would share that too. I think bonds and attachment are created through consistency and connection. And a man and a father is just as capable of doing that as a woman. Although I think our society is set up in such a way that women do spend more time with children and women are more consistent with their kids. And that is set up because society rewards women who are able to do that more than men.
I do hear more cases, though, of women seeming to be very, very nervous about my son or my daughter going off to college. It's the mother who calls. We call them helicopter parents sometimes. Mm-hmm. And where were you yesterday when I called? Weren't you in your dorm room and stuff? That tends to be the mother, not the father.
Yeah, I think it depends. But I think a big part of that, again, is the socialization of women expecting. So I'll give you a perfect example, personal perfect example. My husband works very close to my daughter's daycare. I work an hour away. So when Jess gets sick, on the sheet, it's instructed for them to call him, not me. They never call him. They always call me.
Wow.
And even though I'm an hour away and I eventually have to call him to go pick her up, the implication is that it's me who's going to do it. And I think those messages get read so often by moms, and there's so much mother shaming going on in our society, that women genuinely feel very guilty when they can't do those types of things. And so I think why does that happen at, by the time they're 18 is because everything in your life sets you up to feel like you're responsible for that.
Dr. Kate Richmond, believe it or not, our time is up. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise. Thank you so much.
Yes, we have learned a lot during this past hour about women and men in society, feminism. And let me just mention once again that Dr. Kate Richmond, Associate Professor of Psychology and Director of Women and Gender Studies at Muhlenberg College, has a book that is upcoming called Psychology of Women, published by W.W. Norton, and should be coming out in January 2019. So congratulations on the book.
Thank you. We're really excited.
I know
excited.
It's been a long time. It's been about 3 years.
3 years from start to finish. Yep.
Good for you.
Thank you.
Listeners, we appreciate your tuning in this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm your host, John Pierce. Our board operator, Neil Heaver, who directs operations here at WDIY. And until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.